to John Swinfield's Big Business Podcast. And now, let me introduce your host, journalist and writer, John Swinfield.
Hello, I'm John Swinfield. Welcome to Big Business. I'm a journalist and television producer, and I've spent much of my life writing and making films about business bosses. I hope you find this pod gossipy, irreverent, informative, and even fun. If you like the feed, please don't forget to click the subscriber button. Big Business is on every week at 11 a.m. GMT on Wednesdays. In part one of this saga about a TV film I made about the fraudster Robert Maxwell, I recounted how he had duped me about filming with him in Russia. An exciting trip, which never actually happened. The next filming location was in Israel. Maxwell was to speak at the Jerusalem Book Fair. We'd arranged to meet at the Holocaust Memorial for an interview. The night before, he and his wife Betty summoned me to their suite at the King David Hotel. He sat on a dressing table chair, which he'd reversed, his bulging thighs either side of it. His unblinking gaze fastened on me in an oddly demented way, as if pretending he could see through me. It was a look I'd grown familiar with, but it still seemed mildly unhinged. Maxwell began his interrogation. He wanted to know in precise detail what I was going to ask him in the morning. He said if I wouldn't tell him, he was going to pull out. Simple as that. I told him I wouldn't tell him the specific questions in advance, and anyway, most of them would be follow-ups, invented on the spot in response to his answers. I explained that I didn't want to catch him out, which he didn't believe, and frankly, neither did I, and that if I had given him each question, he'd try to memorise answers and the interview would seem scripted. He'd come across as wooden, a bad actor trying to remember rehearsed lines. To pacify him, I ran through the general area of questioning. One must be fully briefed in dealing with interviews of Maxwell's calibre, or they can eat you alive and spit out the bones. It's crucial to listen to answers, to think quickly, and then to ask, if possible, well-framed follow-ups. Sometimes intended questions have to be jettisoned or used only as supplementary inquiries. Sticking to a pre-prepared list can allow revelatory remarks to go unexplored. At some point during his questioning, he abruptly changed tack, saying the real reason he didn't want to do the interview was because he was a Jew and he was always moved to tears at Jerusalem's Holocaust Memorial. Betty nodded her agreement. Eventually, he agreed to go ahead, as we had planned. We shook hands and said we'd meet as arranged the next morning at the memorial. I didn't sleep much for the few hours that were left, not because I was worried about the interview, but because I thought he might change his mind and not show up. With Maxwell, that was always a possibility. It was his way. But he materialised and, to my surprise, was wearing a cream suit with a matching cream skull cap, adorned with a sparkly braid. I got it into my head that if he did appear, it would be mournful and he'd wear something dark and funereal. This looked like a television suit, a look-at-me outfit, bought especially and tailored for the occasion. So perhaps he'd been toying with me, testing my mettle, seeing if I would bend as he tightened the screw, never intending to walk away from the interview. After all, why bother to go to all the trouble of acquiring such a natty outfit? So here he was, laughing, cracking jokes, full of bonhomie, glad-handing onlookers, unrecognisable as the Maxwell of the previous night, prancing around in a cream suit and a sparkling skullcap, like a bloated Barry Manilow about to perform Copacabana. To kick off, I asked something innocuous, just to get the conversation flowing. One always saves the best questions till last, when you're almost out of the door, when the bulk of the interview is safely in the can. We were sitting side by side on a low wall outside the Holocaust Memorial. He suddenly jumped up and stalked away, pulling off the microphone that we'd pinned to his lapel. I ran after him, feeling a touch foolish, but I was getting used to his pantomime histrionics. They merely made me more determined. When we were out of earshot of the film crew and a knot of nosy bystanders, he turned on me, his face flushed and angry. "Sign this," he said. He'd fished a tatty piece of paper from an inside pocket, a list of demands giving him full and uncontrolled editing rights over the film before transmission. I explained that I couldn't possibly sign it. I wasn't in the habit of making or transmitting censored documentaries approved by their subject. "In that case," he said, "I'm off." He turned and strode away, taking Betty's arm. He timed it to perfection. He knew I'd blown a hole in the budget and that if he quit, I'd only have half a film and be unable to cobble anything together which would be worth showing. He had put me in a cruel dilemma, and he knew it. So I signed. I had no option and every intention of fighting it later. He took the scrap of paper and put it into his suit. He'd read my mind. "Don't even think about trying to get out of it. I'll come after you. My lawyers will take you apart. They'll have a heyday." With that, he was once again all smiles, a new man, utterly transformed. He shook my hand. Warm and smiling, he hugged me to his great chest. I was in the clutches of the Carpathian bear. "We'll make an excellent film. It'll be a winner," he said. Maxwell had litigation like a disease. I had no doubt he'd activated the bit of paper that I'd just signed. After the storm, the sun. Maxwell's wrath had vaporized. Within seconds, he was chuckling and chatting happily about the sophisticated delights of Jerusalem. He resumed his interview position, sitting on the low wall next to me. After he had carefully adjusted his skullcap, we did the interview. He was fluent and composed. As he recalled his childhood, there was a tear. Maxwell was an explosive mix of sentimental and hard-eyed. Inside the gloom of the Holocaust Memorial, a vast rounded chamber cut into a hillside, I asked him to stand by the eternal flame, a light since Israel's foundation in 1948. Not wanting to dispel the affecting shadowy ambience by installing glaring TV lights, I asked him to stand near the small flame, which would gently illuminate his heavy features. The idea was simple. He would look down on the flame, his head bowed as if in sorrow, and on cue he would nudge the small gas key with his foot so that the flame would slowly grow, bathing his red, fleshy countenance in its warm glow. The movement of his foot would be so slight it would be hidden in the darkness from the viewer. In the days I spent with him, I had learned that he could be a first-class actor. This little sequence would not be difficult for him. I told him to look contemplative, mournful, but not to overdo it, as if remembering his anguished youth. As a child, the Nazi hordes had overrun his home in Czechoslovakia and taken his parents off to the camps. He had managed to run away and hide, to emerge later as a sniper sergeant in the British lines. He screwed up his jowls, staring into the small flame, head bowed low, shoulders down, looking pitiably sad. One two, three, Q-Bob, I said very softly, not wanting to disturb the atmosphere in this most sacred of shrines. Heavily built, at times clumsy, he kicked the tiny key too hard, and an enormous roaring flame shot up into the blackness. He reeled back, dislodging his skullcap. To my relief, and certainly his, he was unscathed and would smartly recover. We tried again. Take two. This time, he hardly dared to move his foot, nudging the key the wrong way, snuffing out the flame, almost casting the Holocaust Memorial into darkness for the first time since 1948. I thought we'd be mired in scandal, splashed across the Jerusalem Post. But the flame was swiftly adjusted, and at the third attempt, we were successful, without singeing Maxwell, his cream suit, or his sparkly skullcap. The last time I saw Maxwell was at his 65th birthday bash at Headington Hill Hall. He'd invited me to film it and to vox pops the guests, the creme de la creme of the British political left, and a multitude more drawn from the city and show business. The film crew and I were dolled up in dinner dress. It was strictly a black tie affair. Cavalcades of limos queued up on the stately gravel drive. Guest helicopters landed on the immaculately trimmed lawns. I collared a few people and started to ask them what they thought of their host. Suddenly, Maxwell bustled over, pushing through the bejeweled throng. Almost frog-marching me into a side room, he upbraided me about picking people at random. I had to seek his approval, clearing their names and having my questions vetted and approved by him. I said he was being unreasonable, which sent him into meltdown. He had previously agreed to let me talk to whoever I wished and to ask whatever I wanted. Again, I had to remind him I didn't make censored shows, a debate we had had countless times before. After weeks of being pressured and hassled, biting my tongue, tolerating his alarming mood swings and his hectoring, I'd had enough. I wished him a happy evening and quit, telling him he could stuff his party and shove his magnums of Dom Perignon where the sun didn't shine. Though I put it more courteously, of course. We shook hands and I walked out, followed by the crew. We hadn't shot much partying, but I got enough. My film was in the can. Party sequences might have been fun, but it was really just an extra dollop of jam which I could live without. And what of my signed so-called agreement, giving him overall control and editing rights? During the 2 weeks of editing, I was on tenterhooks but heard nothing. 2 days before transmission, it was to run on Britain's Channel 4 at 8 p.m. on a Saturday night, a good slot. Maxwell and his lawyers broke cover. Their late move was timed to cause maximum impact and embarrassment just before transmission. They demanded to see the film before it went out. I refused. My boss and the lawyers backed me. Maxwell sought an injunction. A judge saw it in private and ruled that it could run untouched. Maxwell's so-called agreement was signed under duress, and as such had meant nothing. The film was sparky, informing, and well received by critics and viewers. As I've mentioned, nobody really knew the entirety of Maxwell's chicanery until the shocking story poured out after his death. Some weeks after transmission, I happened to be with Sirocco 40, one of Britain's leading hoteliers. Rocco said, "Bumped into that chap Maxwell at some do the other day. Odd sort of fellow, isn't he? Asked me if I'd seen his film. I said no, sadly I hadn't. He said I really ought to do so. And then he strode off, talking to other people. People often ask me how I thought Maxwell died. Did he jump off his boat? Was it suicide? Well, I don't believe so. Things were certainly bad. The world and his creditors were closing in. But he loved conflict. He was unyielding, a risk-taker, an insane gambler. He had a mad courage, and he'd faced down monumental challenges in the past. When I made my film, he'd already been branded by city watchdogs, the Department of Trade and Industry, as being unfit to run a public company, an admonishment so severe it would have finished most people. Yet the bouncing check bounced back, as he always did. Was he murdered? He was an impassioned defender of Israel. Was he perhaps an Israeli spy? There was a mysterious period when he went into hiding between the Nazis invading his home and the murder of his parents, and later popping up in the British lines. A strapping lad, aged 15 or 16, he was physically strong, clever, and he had every reason to hate Germany, the Nazis, and right-wing politics. Could he have been recruited by the Soviet Union? As well as the invading German army, Soviet agents were in Czechoslovakia at the time. He certainly knew the post-war Russian leaders, and to a degree was fated in the Soviet Union. It was one of the reasons for the success of his Pergamon publishing company. In its early years, Maxwell laid the foundations of his empire, at least in part, by somehow acquiring and publishing priceless scientific research papers, some of which have been salvaged from the ruins of Berlin. Such stories feed the many legends that still swirl around Maxwell. Since his death, there's been a mountain of tripe talked and written about Maxwell from people who didn't know him, who had never met or hardly knew him, or who had an axe to grind. I spent weeks at close quarters with him, in his business, at his home, overseas, sitting at the kitchen table with family and friends, and with Betty, his gracious wife. Apart, perhaps, from Betty, I doubt really that anybody really knew Maxwell. My theory about his death is prosaic. He fell off the back of his super yacht, the Ghislaine, named after his daughter, and drowned. An accident. Maxwell was hyperactive. He had a frenetic brain. He couldn't switch off and sometimes slept badly. He'd wake in the middle of the night and wander around, his mind working feverishly. Sometimes he'd have a nightcap or two. If he'd been lounging at the stern and the craft had unexpectedly pitched around for some reason, he could easily have fallen overboard and nobody would have noticed. The Ghislaine is sizable, with the engines humming and the captain and the officers of the night watch on the bridge some distance from the stern, it's feasible that nobody would have heard a splash or a scream. Maxwell's life was so extraordinary, it seems unimaginable that his death could be as ordinary as falling off a boat. He was buried in Jerusalem's Mount of Olives Cemetery. An Israeli taxi driver told me a joke. He's buried there, but nobody knows, of course, how long he'll be staying. You've been listening to Big Business. This is John Swinfield signing off. Don't forget to click on subscribe. I'm on every Wednesday at 11 a.m. GMT.